Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Today, we take you to Point Lookout on Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The speaker is Professor Paul Pilar, a career professional in the U.S. intelligence community. Professor Pilar served in the National Intelligence Council as one of the original members of its analytic group. He has been executive assistant to the CIA's Deputy Director for Intelligence and executive assistant to Director of Central Intelligence, William Webster. Professor Pilar is now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, as well as a non-resident senior fellow in the Brookings Institution's Center for 21st Century Security. Professor Pilar is now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, as well as a non-resident senior fellow in the Professor Pilar is now a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, as well as a non-resident senior fellow in the Brookings Institution's Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. This program will be archived on our website, mppn.net, where it is available for streaming and as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Mac DeFord.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the July meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983. By a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 250, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Paul Pilar. He is currently a non-resident senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies, and also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for 21st Century for Security and Intelligence. He received his BA from Dartmouth, his doctorate from Princeton. He's a retired officer in the United States Army Reserve, having served on active duty in the early 1970s, which included a tour in Vietnam. He was a career CIA officer, retiring after 28 years in 2005. His last job at the agency was as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. So he's got plenty of background from which to discuss his topic, Why America Misunderstands the World. Paul.
Thank you very much, Mac, and my thanks to the forum for this invitation. My wife and I have had the pleasure of vacationing in Maine, including this part of the Midcoast, a couple of times, and we're delighted to get back, especially with the lovely weather you gave us. I'm going to talk about some thoughts in this book that Mac mentioned, and I should lead into it by saying I got to it as a result of some work I did on a previous book, which I published 5 years ago, on intelligence in U.S. foreign policy. And one of the observations I made there was that if you look at the really big foreign policy decisions through the years, at least since World War II, I mean big ones like going to war or reorientations of U.S. grand strategy, and you ask, what were the images of the situations overseas that our policymakers had in mind when they made those decisions, and where did those images come from? The answer is no, they didn't come from a bureaucracy like an intelligence agency, even though that's the textbook way of answering that question. They come from elsewhere. And this newest book is a look at one of those important places where those images come, and that is our shared national experience as Americans. America is exceptional. We can agree on that, I think, even if we don't agree with all the tub-thumping rhetoric that comes under American exceptionalism. But history's seen nothing like it. You know, the world's only superpower, lots of other things that are unique. And the effects of being exceptional include not only a distinctive national character and creed, and there have been generations of scholars and foreign observers who have talked about the American character and come up with remarkably similar conclusions through the years, but also distinctive habits of how we as Americans, based on this national experience, view the outside world. I'm going to spare you the social science, but it's basically a matter of how a nation's culture is shaped by all the physical, political, economic, social, historical circumstances that have made the nation what it is. Or to put it differently, American culture and everything that went into it, including our geographic circumstances, our history, and so on, serves as a kind of prism that distorts and slants and colors the way we see the outside world. Now, all this would be of little interest to anyone other than scholars and students of public opinion if it didn't have significant implications for policy, U.S. foreign policy, and I would argue it does in at least two respects. One, policymakers are Americans too. They came out of the same history, the same culture. Their view of the outside world is fashioned in many of the same ways that the rest of us fashion our view. And second, even if you have the most knowledgeable, most perspicacious leader who is doing our policy, with accurate and carefully compiled images of the outside world, our leaders operate in a political environment that is shaped by public opinion and conventional wisdom. And that sets limits on what a leader can do. Walter Lippmann wrote about this years ago, and he said, I quote, "With exceptions so rare that they are regarded as miracles and freaks of nature, successful democratic politicians are insecure and intimidated men, or women. They advance politically only as they placate, appease, bribe, seduce, bamboozle, or otherwise manage to manipulate the demanding and threatening elements in their constituencies," unquote. So if the public has certain slanted, colored, distorted views of the outside world, that's inevitably going to set political limits on what our leaders can do. Now, any effect of this American prism overlays a baseline of, to be quite blunt, relative ignorance about the outside world. And I hasten to add, I'm not talking about the people in this room, and I dare say most of you who are listening on the radio, but for the public as a whole, this has to do with the fact that we Americans, we speak the English language, which is dominant worldwide. The U.S. economy is the biggest economy in the world. There are a number of reasons why Americans feel more comfortable in having insular attitudes and not feeling as much need as many other people do in other countries to become knowledgeable about the rest of the world. And this comes up in poll after poll. I mean, for example, in one survey of Americans aged 18 to 24, when they were handed a map of the Middle East, 6 out of 10 could not locate Iraq, and 3/4 of them could not find Israel. In sum, the American national experience contributes to significant misperceptions about the outside world that can be related directly to aspects of that experience in terms of geography, history, and all those other things I mentioned, and that because of that relationship can be said to be distinctly American and that have significant effects on public policy. We could say this is a downside of American exceptionalism. Now, before I dive into some of the more specifics, let me just throw out a few cautions and caveats. The United States obviously is not the only nation that has blind spots and distorting factors in looking at the outside world, but it's worth talking about because, number one, it's our country. Number two, it's the most important country in the world. And number three, because it is so much different, the only superpower and so forth, I think most of what I say about unique viewpoints based on national history apply at least as much to us Americans as it does to anyone else. Another caveat, we obviously don't agree on everything. When I talk about conventional wisdom, well, we clearly have lots of divisions among ourselves, but those are often policy preferences that are based on an underlying agreement of some of the essentials, and I'll get to more of that later. The factors I'm addressing are not necessarily the only ones that shape how Americans think about world affairs, but I'm talking about certain tendencies in thought and perception, tendencies that are strong and significant. And finally, it's not all misperception. You know, we've had a lot of very successful policies through the years that have been backed up by very accurate views of the outside world. But often because of those tendencies of the prism to distort and slant, the clear and accurate thinking does not prevail. or when it does prevail, it is only after a struggle to overcome the more clouded thinking. Okay, more specifics. I would start, with regard to the American experience, with the fact that we're behind two big ocean moats. We're geographically separate from so much of the rest of the world, and that explains an awful lot. You know, by the time Americans, that is to say, citizens of the United States, made contact with others in North America, our friends to the north and south, we were already the big kid on the continent, strong enough that that really wasn't a threat for us. And the continental United States, because of that separation, was almost untouched even by the great world wars of the 20th century. Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, said, "The U.S. was kindly separated by nature and a wide ocean from the exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe," unquote. Those more religiously inclined than the deist Jefferson would see this as part of how America was favored by Providence. The idea of foreordained invulnerability, and that slides into a notion of invulnerability in other respects as well. And this is a very major underlying factor in innate American optimism that has shown up through the years, and what has proven to be over-optimism in many endeavors, including some of our more recent ones. The geographic separation has also fostered more of a sense of separation between what we see as a wise and virtuous America and the rest of the world with more negative attributes. There's more of a sharp distinction in our American thinking between the homeland and the rest of the world than there is, say, for Europeans, where much of the territory of the continent has changed hands through the years as wars have fought and kings have traded territory, and you've had supranational institutions from the Holy Roman Empire to the European Union rising above national sovereignty. We haven't had any of that stuff. It's America, the United States, very distinct and very separate and very well defined, and then the rest of the world. And this especially sharp, dichotomous view of home and abroad has at times underlain isolationism, but more often in recent years, it has supported the idea of intervention by the United States, with the underlying idea that what is wise and virtuous in America, such as our love of democracy, if it can be sloughed off on others in that outside world, it can be only for their own betterment and not just for our own. When the Englishman Rudyard Kipling wrote his poem, The White Man's Burden, he initially started it with Queen Victoria's Jubilee in mind, but when he finally published it, it was with a subtitle indicating he was referring to the United States takeover of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. That's when the United States got into the colonialism business. Except we Americans don't call it colonialism. We use euphemisms like phase four. And the negative perceptions of it are not recognized. We did not anticipate the negative reactions in the Philippines back after 1898. And we didn't in other places, countless places, including more recently Iraq. The biggest consequence of enjoying that free security of the two ocean moats is difficulty in understanding the fears and the insecurities of other nations not similarly blessed. Here again, we're a lot different from the Europeans, especially small countries like Belgium, say, which has been the grass that has been trampled as elephants have fought on its continent. You know, we're the un-Belgium. But it's true even of larger countries. Take Germany. You had Otto von Bismarck, the German chancellor, conducting secret diplomacy because of the fear that Germany has had all along, even though it's the big kid on the European continent, of a two-front war, of being surrounded by other adversaries. The American rejection of that kind of thinking was embodied in Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, the first point of which, when the U.S. entered World War I, was open covenants openly arrived at. And Wilson derided the Prussian autocracy that was responsible for the war. I would suggest that this is reflects a misunderstanding. I'm not singling out Wilson, but I'm talking about the overall American viewpoint of what Bismarck was doing and why he was doing it. It was because Germany, strong as it was on a continent with a lot of other potentially threatening enemy powers. We haven't had that experience. Similarly, there's an insufficient appreciation of lesser states' need to accommodate more powerful neighbors. One term that's come up repeatedly in discussions of foreign relations has been Finlandization, which first came up back in the 1950s, and it referred to how the Finns accommodated the Soviets in a number of ways to make sure they tried to maintain their independence. And the way they accommodated the Soviet was through various agreements with Soviet policy that we Americans certainly did not like. And so Finlandization became a dirty word in the 50s and then arose again in the 1980s. We didn't really understand, what that kind of situation for Finland was because we've never had a nearby neighbor that threatened us. We also didn't understand why, after Saddam Hussein was overthrown in Iraq, that one of the tendencies in post-Saddam Iraq would be to develop good relations with the next door neighbor, Iran. And so one of the consequences of the Iraq war was a major increase in Iranian influence with its improved relations with Iraq. We don't understand that kind of thing. And again, recently in Ukraine, it's hard for us to understand, put ourselves in the shoes of Ukrainians or Russians to understand how the relationship between those two countries, because of geography, is inevitably going to have to be close in many respects if we're not going to have some kind of war breaking out. Finlandization was a term that came up again in a lot of discussion in this country over the last couple of years talking about Ukraine. The exceptions to that that I've noted in some of the public discourse came from Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who used the term Finlandization favorably, saying this is the sort of policy that a neutral Ukraine needs to have to exist peacefully alongside Russia. Well, those two old strategists, they came out of the European school of thinking. They said those things not because they were American officials and Americans, as they are, but because their tradition, their basis, was the European one that was much different. There is also an insensitivity to how other nations perceive the United States itself as a threat. Again, because we haven't had that experience ourselves. The Canadians and the Mexicans, despite what Trump says about the Mexicans, aren't really a threat to us. Many polls have shown, poll after poll, have shown wide divergence between how Americans see the American involvement in the world and how others see it in terms of the others often seeing the United States as not taking account of their own interests and even seeing it as a threat. We don't think of ourselves as a threat. Other people do. Where foreign beliefs, even among some friends and allies, have that kind of perception that I just mentioned, seeing us as a threat. By contrast, the prevailing American view, I think, was summed up very well by President George W. Bush when he said a month after 9/11, and I quote, "I'm amazed that there is such misunderstanding of what our country is about, that people would hate us. I am, like most Americans, I just can't believe it, because I know how good we are, and we've got to do a better job of making our case," unquote. In other words, if people hate us and they see us as threats, that's just because we haven't gotten our message across. It's because of something more basic. And so this leads to surprise in the negative reactions of others that we weren't expecting in places like Iraq, and dashed expectations when we expected to be greeted with sweets and flowers. Now, Americans have had an unusually good set of circumstances in other respects, too, not just with the ocean moats, but other geographic and physical things that we've been blessed with. We have a rich homeland with some of the most fertile soil on Earth. We're the home of the petroleum industry because of our oil resources. I can go on and on. And not only do we have the resources, but it came easily to us. The land came easily to us. You look at the various ways in which the United States grew geographically, and stuff almost dropped in our laps. Florida we got because the Spaniards were in a real bad way with the Peninsula Wars, and they said, take it. The Louisiana Purchase we got for, 4 cents an acre or something like that, because Napoleon was concerned about some slave revolt in Haiti. We picked up Alaska even more cheaply because the Russians were afraid they were going to lose it to the British anyway with the Crimean War, things like that. We didn't have to fight very hard for this. And as far as the Native Americans were concerned, they were few enough that they were easily marginalized. Now, this led to a tendency to think that we Americans had it coming, or in Mr. Bush's words, because of how good we are. And polls have shown repeatedly, as far as American opinion is concerned, that America is not only bigger and stronger and more important, but morally superior in the view of many Americans to other countries. This has led to surprise and consternation when others don't see U.S. policy overseas in the same way. It's also added to overconfidence about our success overseas. We had expansion in North America that came so easily. This led to the idea of manifest destiny. And then when we filled in the continent and the frontier was closed in the 1890s, we just continued on overseas, you know, with the Spanish-American War and the rest. The Plains Indians had put up just enough of a fight in the latter part of the 19th century to make it a little interesting and to make it look like we really did have to fight, even though, as I say, in general, the Native Americans were marginalized pretty easily. This leads to a tendency to underestimate adversaries, especially those of markedly different ethnicities, like in Vietnam, which Lyndon Johnson once referred to as a pissant nation. And then his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, when he wrote a book years later with lamenting all the mistakes of Vietnam, he said, "We underestimated the power of nationalism to motivate a people, in this case the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, to fight and die for their beliefs and values." Slowness in recognizing how much more common it is than here in North America for different peoples to struggle and fight over the same land is another consequence of having had it so easily. And this has arisen in various places, but I think probably the best example involves the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. There's a strong American siding with Israel, which is well known. It's overdetermined. I'm not going to go into that. And the preference underlies the perceptions. There are many respects in which numerous misperceptions about the conflict flow from the preferences. But the one thing I'd like to point out that's consistent with what I'm talking about today is a denial that this is really a struggle between two peoples for the same land, an experience that we haven't had. There are other, you know, parallels that have been drawn through the years between the American experience and the Israeli experience, especially with religious connotations being injected into it by some people, and the idea of making the prairie or the desert bloom. So there's been a tendency to think that because of some parallels like that, then everything is parallel between our experience and that of the Israelis. So we've gotten a lot of adherence in this country, in looking at that conflict over there in the Middle East, to the notion of a land without people for a people without a land, overlooking that there was a people there. And with American politicians saying, and there's a whole bundle of quotes on this, that Palestinians don't exist and are an invented people. Now, as with many matters involving Israel, Americans don't talk as openly and honestly about these things as Israelis themselves have. David Ben-Gurion, one of the founding fathers of Israel, speaking in 1919, said, I quote, "There is a gulf, and nothing can fill that gulf. I do not know what an Arab will agree that Palestine should belong to the Jews, even if the Jews learn Arabic. We as a nation want this country to be ours. The Arabs as a nation want this country to be theirs," unquote. A very simple and clear statement of the struggle between two peoples for one land that we don't understand because we didn't have that same kind of struggle. Another effect, we're slow to see the resource challenges that other countries face that we haven't experienced, such as how desperate Japan was before World War II with regard to oil supplies. And the whole history leading up to the Pearl Harbor attack is mostly a story of Japan feeling desperation with regard to oil. We also tend to believe that technologically things can come just as easily to others in areas where we've succeeded. For example, nuclear weapons. We've got a whole history going back to John Kennedy's projection when he was president that we'd have 25 nuclear weapons states, you know, another 20 years or whatever it was Kennedy said. We haven't come close to that. And part of that is because of non-proliferation measures, but part of it is because of our tendency to think that, well, we were able to build nuclear weapons, so anybody who puts a mind to it ought to be able to do that as well. But it's, you know, a lot more difficult than that. And there's the belief that with enough resources and enough determination, just about anything can be done. The Iraq War, again, provides ample examples. Look at what someone like Paul Wolfowitz was saying before the war about how oil wealth that Iraq had would pay for this war. We could do it on the cheap. That was about, you know, several hundred billion dollars ago, and George Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner, has a projection of $3 trillion as the overall cost of the war. Social and political integration and stability have been a big part of the American experience, and another aspect of that experience that is unusual and that shapes our views. And one of the great consequences of this is a difficulty in understanding just how unusual our shared liberal democratic values, with a small L and a small D, are, and how there is much more ideological conflict of a much more fundamental sort that has torn a lot of other countries apart. We have a hard time understanding that. And we like to think, often mistakenly, that the way we were able to put our democratic society together could be applied to other lands fairly easily. It was expressed in George W. Bush's national security strategy in 2002. Quote, America's experience as a great multi-ethnic democracy affirms our conviction that many heritages and faiths can live and prosper in peace, unquote. And that faith, of course, led to some of the mistaken expectations about Iraq, where we have had since then different ethnic and religiously based conflicts playing out in a very costly civil war. The thinking was also involved in the Vietnam War. Frances Fitzgerald, in her best-selling book about the war, wrote, "Never having known a serious ideological struggle in their history, many Americans persisted in thinking of the Vietnamese conflict as a battle between two fixed groups of people with different but conceivably negotiable interests." Unquote. That way of thinking influenced the thinking both of the Johnson administration, which believed that a mutually acceptable solution could be reached with the help of motivation-changing firepower, and to dovish opponents of the administration who believed that a stable and genuine neutralist settlement was possible. They were both wrong. You know, there was a strong nationalist sentiment that produced what is the Vietnam Republic we know now. My friend Frank Fukuyama had his well-known thesis that he came out with 30 years ago about the end of history and how, you know, the liberal democratic ideology represents something that is now so broadly, so widely accepted that it really is, you know, the end of history. And it got such, Frank's thesis got such a big splash here in the United States, especially for something that was basically a work of political philosophy that, you know, most of the masses would not relate to, because it conforms so well with our fundamentally American beliefs about how anyone can have the same sort of liberal democratic blessings that we've had. That set of beliefs has, at various times, taken the form of saying that, you know, the world consists of two types of people, you know, freedom-loving people like us and those who are malevolently inclined and want to deny the aspirations of freedom-loving people. This contributes to a sort of Manichaean view of the world, good versus evil, that greatly oversimplifies all those conflicts out there that have nationalist, ethnic, and religious components. It leads to a failure to understand resistance to the export of democracy. When we say, well, that's just the birth pangs of democracy, and other people say, if that's the birth pangs, I don't want to see the rest of it. And there's the failure to appreciate the role of other values, such as justice, which in the vernacular of a lot of political discussion in other parts of the world, like the Middle East, doesn't just mean procedural fairness like we would in our legal system, but rather refers to things like equality of economic opportunity. And it, most of all, in terms of some more recent security threats that we are concerned with, it inhibits the understanding of really radical behavior, violent behavior, such as that manifests itself in international terrorism. I'm going to quote another George W. Bush speech, this one to Congress after 9/11. "Why do they hate us?" said the president. "They hate what they see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government," unquote. I would respectfully disagree. I mean, there are all kinds of economic, social, and political factors that help explain why any one radical takes the violent path that he does. It's not just a matter of hating democracy. There's one final and important formative American experience I want to comment on, and that is our experience with wars. Wars often are formative experiences for any country. And we had, here in the United States, a long history through World War II that has formed a distinctly American way of looking at foreign wars. We think of them as being relatively infrequent, as they were throughout the 19th century, related to our geographic isolation, in which wars were a periodic sallying forth to slay some threat that was out there, and then permitting us to come back and resume our peacetime habits. It's a very non-Clausewitzian view of war and peace, that they're two separate things, rather than war being a continuation of policy and politics by other means. We've also came to believe that wars have clear and distinct beginnings and endings, and not only endings, but victorious endings. You know, even the one war during that period up to World War II I mentioned that was, you have to score as a draw, the War of 1812, Americans at the time viewed as a victory because the last battle was the Battle of New Orleans, which was a big smashing American win. The world wars of the 20th century continued these patterns and added a couple of others. Each one, although they were multilateral, was a clear division between opposing alliances, the Central Powers versus the Entente, the Axis against the Allies. And also in each case, the main threat and the reason for war was seen as a fixed set of noxious actors pursuing noxious ideologies, and we just had to wipe them out in order to return to peace and harmony. And certainly, during World War II, the Hitler and the Nazis filled very well the role of a noxious set of enemies with a noxious ideology. World War II was the biggest formative experience in the way we still think about wars today. The model of how wars ought to be viewed and fought and ended, including ending with an unconditional surrender of our adversaries. In the subsequent 7 decades, though, these habits of thought have been applied to a lot of conflicts that have taken different forms and to a more continuous U.S. presence overseas. And the fit between how we think about wars and what's actually going on with our overseas presence sometimes hasn't been a very good fit. There was the Cold War, which we treated just like another war, as indicated by the very term Cold War. This encouraged, among other things, the mistake of thinking of international communism as a monolithic entity, just like the Nazis. That was a central misperception, among other things, in the Vietnam War, where the belief going into Vietnam was if we didn't stop communism there, then world communism would continue to, you know, pour red paint around the globe. There also seemed to be a clear ending of the Cold War with the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and especially the dissolution of the USSR. But in fact, this really wasn't like vanquishing the Axis or the unconditional surrenders of the Germans and Japanese in World War II. The idea of a clear victory in the Cold War did not leave appropriate room for thinking about Russia as still there and still a major power with nuclear weapons to boot. And that kind of outdated thinking underlies problems that we've had regarding the expansion of NATO eastward and all the mess in Ukraine and the tensions with Russia that we've experienced over the last couple of years. The application of the American war model to international terrorism, again, as indicated by the terminology, war on terror. has entailed numerous problems. There is an underestimation of threat when we are supposedly at peace and an overestimation of threat when we are supposedly at war. American people thought we weren't very threatened by international terrorism on September 10th, 2001, and then on September 12th, they thought it was the biggest threat we ever faced. Both views were inaccurate. It's resulted in an over-militarization of the entire problem. If you use the war metaphor, the metaphor tends to lead to reality. The idea that if we have a serious threat, then we're at war. If we're at war, that means we must use military force. That is a false logic, but it is a logic that has, in effect, driven a lot of our policies. There is a tendency to see the problem as one more discrete bunch of bad actors with an odious ideology that has to be wiped out. That, again, is a misperception in that you've got terrorism as a tactic that's been used by all different kinds of people with different ideologies through the centuries. And even the ones that we might lump today under the radical Sunni variety vary greatly with regard to what drives the people to do what they do. And yet, we continue to speak of a single movement with terms like Islamofascism, very unhelpful term. And then there's also the belief that there's going to be a definite end here, just like World War II, despite some warnings to the contrary by some of our leaders. And that is underlaying such difficulties as not getting an authorization for the use of military force. We still don't have really an up-to-date one. You know the story of that, I think. And problems like the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists in places like Guantanamo, where President Obama promised in his first year at office he'd close the place. He hasn't managed to do that. He's had opposition to it. But no one has ever really answered the question that if you are incarcerating people the same way you, say, incarcerate prisoners of war, in which there will be a definite ending, and when the war ends, these people go home, what happens when you've got a war that's basically never going to end? That answer has never been given. My conclusion is the downbeat one, that there is not a lot of hope for change in these patterns of misperception. The habits are deeply ingrained, based on our history, based on our culture, our geography. We're not going to get rid of that very easily. Wise leaders can counteract some of the misperceptions, but again, they're limited by, the public conventional wisdom, as Walter Lippmann talked about. But mostly because a lot of the what I call misperception, isn't a matter of just fact A being not really a fact, but rather more general ways of conceiving things. It's not something where one leader can say, this is the truth and that's not. It's a whole pattern of thought, and that's really hard to change, even for the most articulate and charismatic leader. And leaders themselves may manipulate perceptions by playing off the underlying tendencies. I'll go to the Iraq War another time here. The selling of the Iraq War played off on some of these things that I've just talked about. The idea of all adversaries being one monolithic evil thing out there. That helped feed the idea that the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda were in cahoots, even though there was no truth to that. It enabled the sellers of the war, with a lot of advertising on their part along this line, to get, according to at least one poll I saw, two-thirds of the American people by August of 2002 thought that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the 9/11 attack. That is the sort of misbelief that is partly nurtured by our tendency to think of all of our foreign adversaries as, one set of bad guys, just like World War II, the Axis. Ideological interest groups can do the same thing. It helps to explain the longevity of neoconservatism, which is one of the strongest expressions of many of the distinctly American patterns of thought I've described. In fact, you can say neoconservatism is sort of the most muscular form of American exceptionalism. And it's a distinctly American ideology, not something you'd find elsewhere. Now, we have competition among different ways of thinking. I alluded to that at the outset. But in the United States, the dominant competition is the partisan one, Republicans versus Democrats. And that doesn't help the things I'm talking about. That's basically a tribal conflict in which, you know, people who identify as Republicans believe certain things because they hear Republican leaders say it. People who identify as Democrats believe certain things because they hear the leaders of the party they identify with saying that. That does not help public understanding on the sorts of things I'm talking about. If anything, it is an impediment to dispassionate search for the truth. Occasionally, when things really go wrong, there is a potential for learning some lessons. I mean collectively learning, all of us as Americans. But often, those mean just changing certain beliefs within a framework for looking at the world, the framework I've described, without challenging the framework itself. For example, after Vietnam, a lot of people came to accept, well, I guess we were wrong about that monolithic communism stuff. Well, that was a good lesson, but the whole habit of looking at foreign adversaries, not just communists, as monoliths, we haven't shaken that habit. So we come up with things like Islamofascism today. The most basic impediment to change, I would argue, is the strong, even if unstated and unrecognized, constraint on thought that is posed by the public philosophy, the public consensus. It's unrecognized because of the intensity with which we Americans disagree about a lot of other things. You know, we disagree strongly about taxes and abortion and immigration and gun control and lots of other things. So you think, my goodness, there's no consensus out there. But underlying that is some very strongly held conventional wisdom that is difficult to challenge. And I'm going to end with a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, the very perceptive French traveler who wrote 170 years ago, but this is among the things that still applies very much today. He wrote, "I know no country in which there is so little true independence of mind and freedom of discussion as in America." Tocqueville was a wise man. He said a lot of things and a lot of very favorable things about the United States. He says, "In the United States, there is but one sole authority, one single source of strength and success with nothing beyond it," by which he means the majority opinion of the American public. Now, these quotes come from his book, Democracy in America. He's talking about democracy. "In America, the majority raises very formidable barriers to the liberty of opinion. Within those barriers, an author may write whatever he pleases, but he will repent if he ever step beyond them," unquote. I step beyond them in writing this book, but I'm not running for public office or even up for anything subject to Senate confirmation, so I don't have to repent. And I will stop there and walk the talk.
Great, Paul. Lots of food for thought, obviously. If Ben-Gurion's view of the conflict is adopted by the United States, how would that affect U.S. policy? Is it possible?
Well, if it were adopted, it would be an explicit recognition that you have indeed two peoples who were fighting and contesting over the same land, and that it is not just one side that is making the desert bloom and marginalizing a few others who are historically retarded, and we just got to wait to get them out of the way. I mean, yeah, I drew the comparison with the Native Americans, and today I think, according to the U.S. Census, the people who identify themselves as Native Americans, they're only like about 1% of the population or less. And going back through our history, the marginalization was accepted as something that was proper. In the book, I quote Andrew Jackson, who, of course, made his name large part by bashing Indian tribes in the Southeast. And after he became president, his first message to Congress, I quote from it, he says, an inferior breed of humanity that is going to have to just get out of the way and disappear. You know, and it was almost those exact words, the President of the United States speaking. Well, We don't have that, anything close to that in terms of the numbers, and certainly in terms of, you know, justice and what's right in the Israeli-Palestinian side. So it would be, to be quite simple, even-handedness. An even-handed approach toward trying to give the incentives to both sides to come to some kind of compromise, because the only way it's going to be anything other than perpetual conflict and living by the sword forever, as Mr. Netanyahu put it not too long ago, is to have a compromise.
Okay. I've got two related questions here. Two powerful poles of U.S. foreign policy seem to be isolationism and interventionism. And the questioner asks, how did interventionism get the upper hand? The related question is, if the U.S. became more isolationist, would that be a healthy development?
Yeah, good question. I think interventionism got the upper hand for reasons that have to do with this overconfidence and that I alluded to in a shorthand form in the talk, that so many things have come so easily to us, whether it's the technical stuff, whether it's the setting up of a liberal democratic society, that this naturally biases us toward doing more rather than less, to doing something like Iraq as opposed to not doing something like the Iraq War. But I think it's rooted in the strong confidence that if we put our minds and our resources and our determination to something, we can do it, and we can do it successfully. You know, there's hardly anyone who's, or hardly anyone, those who are true isolationists today are a very small minority. I think most of the discussion and debate, they're not even within the zone of relevance on the continuum between interventionism and isolationism. It's more one between those who are more strongly interventionist, particularly either bear the neoconservative label or the label that sometimes is called liberal interventionism, which was more identified with things like the Libyan intervention 5 years ago, versus those who talk about things like offshore balancing or a policy of restraint, which is far, far different from isolationism. And we should bear in mind that isolationism, strictly speaking, is not just don't get involved in military quagmires, but actually get involved less in the world as a whole. And very few people are arguing that today.
This one's about Obama. President Obama seems to take a lower-keyed approach, at least these days, to American power abroad. Some say it's a withdrawal from world leadership. To what extent, what do you think of his policy? Do you think it is less aggressive, and do you think it will continue after his departure?
Certainly President Obama has tried to, you know, tilt the needle away from the interventionist end of the intervention, non-intervention dimension we mentioned before, from where it has been predominantly in the previous several years before he took office. I think the president has indicated in many of his comments, especially of a less formal sort, and I would particularly commend, if you haven't read it, the interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, that he has a very strong understanding of many of these very things I've talked about. And I think he explains it very well. At the same time, you know, he is one of these leaders operating in that political environment with the sorts of constraints I talked about before. You know, he has disappointed many of his followers who are more on the political left in this country, and certainly those who are more on the non-interventionist side, who point to things like, he went back, at least to some degree, into Iraq. Now his most recent announcement is about how many troops we'd still have in Afghanistan, which is a few thousand more than what he said before. People point to the drone strikes, of which there have been far more, and they've been much more rapidly than were taking place under the George W. Bush administration. That's partly an advance in the technology, but it's partly a reflection of high-level decisions. So I think my bottom line would be his understanding is excellent. He's tried to move the needle in worthwhile ways. The people who would fault him, I think, can fault him for maybe not trying to resist the larger political forces moving in the other direction. But that's part of the challenge of being president, especially when you have an opposition party that controls both houses of Congress as they have in the last 2 years.
Okay, this last one is to ask you to give us some answers. And I know you've said in your talk that you don't have all the answers, but you've got five questions. Your fact pattern seems quite sound. How would you change thinking of Americans to accommodate better understanding of the rest of the world? Any hope for the media to educate? Boy, that's an optimistic outlook. Or illuminate Americans. So then what? What can we do to get some more clear and accurate thinking? What can be done to improve our understanding of the rest of the world?
All right, this will be an evasive answer again, but you know, I have an intelligence background. I sort of alluded to this briefly when I started mentioning how I got into this particular topic. You know, I spent a whole career to work that is supposedly dedicated to doing exactly these sorts of things, you know, providing the correct analysis and the correct way to interpret the outside world to our policymakers. That's what the intelligence community is all about, in addition to more tactical sources of support. I think, you know, the colleagues I knew and the organizations I was part of tried to do that, you know, some successes, some failures. You can always, in retrospect, point out the ways in which we could have done better or we just did poorly overall. But I think one of the bigger things I took away from that experience was the observation I began with at the start of my comments, that if you're focusing on the really big decisions, this just isn't where they come from. And let me just toss out a couple of the examples here. When Harry Truman made the big decision to go into Korea after the North Koreans invaded the South on June 25th, 1950. When this invasion happened, he was off at his home in Independence, Missouri. And he got a couple of phone calls from Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of State, just passing on a couple of the news bulletins. So he got in his plane, flew back home. That time it took about 3 hours to fly from St. Louis back to Washington. And it was during the plane ride, all he had were these initial news reports, and then he was just had the time to think about history. You can read in his memoirs, or he was recreating his thought process. And by the time he stepped off the plane at National Airport in Washington, was greeted by Lewis Johnson, the Secretary of Defense, he said, "We're going to hit them. We're going to hit them hard." He had already made his decision with no intelligence input at all to go to war. Another example, and I have very high regard for this, you know, what Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did with the opening to China. And they did everything they possibly could to exclude the bureaucracy, not just the intelligence community, but the State Department. The Secretary of State was lied to by Nixon when he said, when Kissinger was already going over the Himalayas for his first visit, this was just something that the Chinese came up with at the last minute. Not telling the Secretary of State all the stuff that had gone on before that. And then, of course, the big thing that was a huge part of what I was personally exposed to in the last 5 years of my career when I was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia was the whole Iraq War thing, which was not driven by intelligence. We hear so much about weapons of mass destruction. That wasn't the issue. As Paul Wolfowitz said, that was just something we could agree on because we couldn't disagree on a bunch of other stuff in order to get the public support for the war. The huge part of the case about the terrorist connections, you know, the Iraqi regime and al-Qaeda, that was completely contrary to what the intelligence community was saying. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, what really mattered in the Iraq War? You know, why did the British just have a 2.6 million word Chilcot report on this topic? Which, by the way, we haven't had anything like that. I wish we did. It wasn't, it wasn't these rationales for the war. It was because it became a very costly, destructive, destabilizing war over the subsequent 8.5 years for us. It would have been just as costly and destructive and destabilizing if every word the Bush administration had said about weapons of mass destruction had been true. Conversely, if peace and security and stability had broken out in Iraq, like many of the war promoters had wanted it to do, we wouldn't have 2.6 million word reports. We wouldn't be considering it a big blunder. And nobody would care about WMD. You know, the Iraqis have democracy. Isn't that enough? So, you know, with that kind of experience, I think I can be excused a somewhat hard-boiled view on this question about, hey, come up with an answer. Well, I plugged away at it for 28 years. And that last set of episodes, and let me just, I didn't really finish the story. You know, the infamous intelligence estimate about WMD was just one of three major intelligence community assessments that was done before the war about Iraq. It was requested by Democrats in Congress. The other two I initiated, although officially Richard Haass, as Director of Policy Planning, was the initiator. You can see it. You can read redacted versions of these other two assessments on the Senate Intelligence Committee website, which finally put them out on a delayed basis. They had to do with, one of them was called Principal Consequences of Regime Change in Iraq. And the other one was regional consequences of post-Saddam Iraq or something like that. You could form your own judgment, but I think it's fair to say they foresaw most of the mess that would take place with regard to the ethnic and religiously based conflict, the refugee problems, the economic problems. We said, for example, on the economy, we need something comparable to a Marshall Plan to put Iraq both back on its feet despite all that oil wealth. These were published before the war began. They were ignored. That's why I'm hard-boiled about this. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, that's, we try to end on an optimistic note.
Sorry about that.
We don't always succeed, but, but I'm with you, Paul. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Professor Paul Pilar, addressing the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, where it is available for streaming and podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.